This is Bob Fetrakis with The Other Side of the News, brought to you by thefreepress.org. WCRS Community Radio 98.3 and 102.1.
This is Bob Fetrakis in the studio here at WCRS, your community radio. I'm speaking with Dr. Marilyn Howard. This will be airing on Martin Luther King's birthday. And our question, well, his official holiday, his birthday was on the 15th. We talked about that here in the studio prior to the show, but on his official national holiday, close to his birthday, you'll be hearing this on Martin Luther King Day. Marilyn, you teach African-American studies at Columbus State.
I do indeed.
And what is the King legacy, and is there any controversy surrounding it?
Well, one of the slightly amusing things I have seen in the last few years is how the people on the right have co-opted Dr. King, particularly speaking as though he would agree with their agenda and so forth. And because people only pay attention to maybe two of his speeches out of the hundreds he gave, it's very easy to pull these things out of context. So what everybody does is they take a hold of the, I want my children to grow up in a country where their character is more important than their color, mm-hmm. and they pounce on that. That means Dr. King wanted a colorblind world, no affirmative action, no blah, 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 you know, like
right,
that.
Right, right. Yeah,
and so...
Yeah.
And so, and then the other half is to have turned him into a myth, almost like a cardboard cutout. And I think there's so many things he left us that are so much more important than that. And so I think if we do that, then as individuals, we don't have to pay attention to whether or not we are being active to continue his work. We can just say, oh, he was this extraordinary person. He's very special. I can't do this. I'm no one. Why? Well, you know, I remind my students in my history classes that college students turned a president out of office in 1968. Of course they can do something.
Well, one of the interesting things to me is that in Columbus, many hardcore activists, black activists and their white allies for years criticized, and maybe Martin Luther King right there calling us from heaven. Let me see if I can shut that phone off. All I'm doing is pulling out
keys. Oh, that's you, not me.
keys in a wallet. All right. Let's see. Well, activists for years have criticized, in Columbus, for example, is that the large corporations seem to control and sponsor the breakfast. I know Nationwide was protested a few years back because it sponsors the King Breakfast, but that same year had been found to be redlining the black low-income neighborhoods of the inner city. And, of course, the March to Nowhere, where you're essentially mainstream politicians march from City Hall to the Vets, you know, Memorial, and the standard, I have a dream speech is dissected for the, you know, 40th time. But in reality, I mean, Martin Luther King marched in dangerous situations, which got him, you know, not only arrested, but put him in harm's way and nearly killed.
Yeah, he, I don't know if we're allowed to swear on the air, are we?
Well, this is actually FM.
Okay. No, he was a revolutionary. He was a true revolutionary in the, if you're a Christian and you believe that there was a figure called Jesus, in that mold. You know, some of the young...
Well, prophetic. I mean,
yes,
he had
a
clearly
Jeremiah,
prophetic
yes.
vision.
Yes.
And fell in that that tradition.
Yes.
Well, I mean,
you know...
And again, some have argued, including myself, that if we mean by prophet, sort of envisioning the possibility of the shapes of things to come if you go down certain corridors and into certain directions. But clearly some said that he may have anticipated his death, he knew he had a lot of enemies. And that last public speech, he said, right, he wasn't fearing any man, and that he might not get to the mountaintop, causing many people to think that he knew the forces that he was up against, particularly there in Memphis, mm-hmm. when he was taking on not the issue of civil rights per se, but the issue of social justice.
And economic rights, yes. He was the son and grandson and great-grandson of preachers. Mm-hmm. He was a Black Baptist who had been reared in the South, albeit in a middle-class family. His wife grew up in
a young Black activist accused some of those Baptist ministers, and perhaps Martin Luther King did himself, suggesting they may have been bought off.
Yeah, well, one of the reasons, allegedly, that he was chosen to lead the Montgomery bus boycott was that he was new to the neighborhood and no one had had a chance to get their hands on him. No one in the power
unbought
structure.
And unbossed.
Like Shirley Chisholm, yeah. So, people forget his religious background. You couple that with the fact that every last one of us is going to leave out of here in a box or a bag. You couple that with the fact that, just a year before he had spoken out against the Vietnam War and chastised Lyndon Johnson about how much they spent on the war and how little mm-hmm. he spent on the war on poverty, given the threats and his house had been bombed and things like that. Yeah, he knew, I think, he was on a short leash. Yeah, he knew that.
So why don't we hear more of that legacy? Why are we stuck with sort of the 1963 speech? No matter how brilliant many people think it is, isn't that just one part of King's personality?
Yeah, he was a multifaceted human being. I mean, in recent years it's come out that some of his works were dangerously close to plagiarism. There have been the allegations of marital infidelity. I don't think these take away from his legacy. It just shows that he's a human being, that he's full-fledged, that he has faults. And things like that. People who didn't know King, they didn't know he loved a good joke, he loved clothes, he loved soul music. He once broke up a meeting with because James Brown was given a concert and he had tickets. So he was a doting father. And one of the things he talked about in Letter from a Birmingham Jail, which was 4 months before the March on Washington speech, was how, as a father, how tongue-tied and sad he was to have to tell his children that, no, you can't go to Funtown, which you've just seen a commercial for, because they don't let colored children go. So he was all these things. And I don't think that frailties or those kinds of things take away from who he was. And I think, too, if we keep our minds focused on that feel-good moment, we don't have to do anything. We don't have to acknowledge, everybody says we're in a post-racial world, we've got a Black president, a Black family in the White House. Well, look what has happened since the Obamas moved into the White House. Anybody who thinks this is a post-racial time is not cooking on all burners. So I think that it allows us to be sort of hands-off and say we don't have to do anything, the work's been done. He's done that. But it also means that we don't have to look at the painful things in America. If we keep our eye on that one sentence in his speech, then we can talk about the flag waving and the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, and we don't have to address all the things that are wrong in America.
The debate that's been ongoing somewhat is whether or not Obama is actually in the tradition of Martin Luther King. His experience, having grown up in Hawaii, mixed race, not Black schools or a minister, but really Ivy League schools, and in many cases some of his first action. I mean, one of the first things he bragged about was not going along with Jesse Jackson in 2000 and... was it 2005, right, when he was elected in 2004, with the challenge by John Lewis, Stephanie Tubbs Jones, to the Electoral College slate in Ohio, based on the suppression of Black voters. And many argue that while he's the culmination of the King tradition, that he himself really wasn't part of that experience.
Well, of course he wasn't. He's decades younger than King was. He has had a whole different experience. But who are these people who think they can define what is black? What is black? What is that?
Well, that's a question. King is popular in part because he seemed to transcend black and talk about oppression universally. I mean, many argue he's Gandhian, is that he's a transcendental leader that, you know, led civil rights in the U.S., the free black people, but he also was leading movements on behalf of the poor people's movement.
Well, if he was such a transcendental figure in that, why is it that the further he got away from talking about the right to sit at a lunch counter, the right to go to the library, the swimming pool, the voting booth, that he lost members, and particularly people such as the president and Congress? You know, people wanted him. They had a vested interest in keeping him in that little box, civil rights leader. And the minute he stepped out of that,
and criticized the Vietnam War, and criticized the high rates of poverty in America.
Look what happened when he went to Chicago. He said he was more frightened in Chicago than he had ever been in Mississippi or Alabama.
Well, and there, because he's dealing with de jure segregation, but hardcore, de facto segregation that people were very afraid in the North of intermixing. Again, the South, we've talked about this on other shows, in that peculiar institution, blacks came to your house every day,
exactly.
Might even live in your house. You interacted with them, but social protocol, you know, as we learned in the maids, the domestic workers, they couldn't go to the bathroom in your house,
exactly.
But they could clean your bathroom.
Didn't care how close you got as long as you didn't get too high. I just think that this whole argument, or this whole Obama's not black, he's too black, he's not black enough, nobody defines that. There's more to that than putting on some kente cloth and putting your hair in dreads or braids or a teeny weeny afro. There's more to the black experience than that, and black people are not monolithic.
But Martin Luther King wasn't a, you know, devout black nationalist.
Well,
he seems in the tradition of the black Southern.
Yeah, that's right. He's a preacher. But you know what? He was proud of being black. He was proud of his full lips and his broad nose and his kinky hair. If you can break up a preacher's meeting to go hear James Brown, I think that makes you black enough.
But in terms of dress,
he grew up,
the motherland and the pilgrimage.
Okay, and that was, in his time, that wasn't something that had bubbled to the surface. But here's the thing. King grew up in a time period, and as somebody who was born in the middle of the boomer age, I grew up hearing that too, that you always present excellence, and that you might be the only black person that white people would have contact with. And so you had to uphold the race all the time. And you can see in his later speeches that burden got kind of heavy for him. He wanted to cut loose every once in a while. Now, here's what, you're raising a larger question, I think, Bob, and that is, if you go to school, if you excel, if you do well, why is it that black people can only be good in athletics and entertainment, but can't be well-spoken, can't be dressed nicely, can't, be refined and so forth? So I think that's a whole different question.
But he didn't seem to embrace the black power movement. You don't get that rhetoric of the black power, the black nationalist in his speeches. He seems well within the American tradition of Frederick Douglass, even say Eugene V. Debs, he quotes the Bible as a minister. You never hear him referring to, at least when I've read his stuff, Fanon, or, he's not talking about the wretched of the earth, but he is talking about the Sermon on the Mount.
Yeah. Again, I think it's context, it's time and place, it's background, it's how he was brought. The man, in the end, the man was a preacher, a black Southern Baptist
and,
preacher.
And a doctor of
divinity.
Yeah.
So, and I don't think, too, he was really he understood. He was not ashamed of being black or any of that kind of, those kinds of things. He didn't have any, oh gosh, I'm black, what's going to happen to me? He didn't have that angst. But he, you know, he really believed in the beloved community. And he said that black separatism was as bad as white separatism. He liked black power as it went, but he was concerned about the separatism.
This is WCRS FM, Columbus Community Radio, 98.3 FM and 102.1. It's Dr. Bob Fetrakis. I'm speaking with Dr. Marilyn Howard, who teaches African American Studies at Columbus State Community College, and we're talking about the King legacy. King himself was attacked from the left in the black community.
He was.
For turning back on occasion and not being confrontational enough?
The second march at the Edmund Pettus Bridge, when he led them to the bottom of the bridge and then stopped to pray and turned back, I think that was the last straw for many of the college students in SNCC. You know, they saw him as being a tool of the establishment. And they lost faith in him at that point. And he knew that.
Why did he do that? I mean, have you ever, what was his
Well, thought? He said that he had never intentionally violated a federal injunction, and they had the marches and things, the demonstrations had been called off while a federal court was considering the case. And so, allegedly, he made kind of a deal with the Kennedy administration, with the Johnson administration, that he would turn back. And so he did. But he, you know, that was, I think that's when he really lost. That was a great turning point for the youngsters in SNCC, and who were sort of more physical in terms of what they were doing for the movement.
Wasn't it a great turning point when he made that speech on April 4th, 1967 at Riverside, arguing that the U.S. government was the greatest force for violence in the world for what they were doing to the people of Vietnam, and that his conscience dictated that he speak out, that he could never confront or talk with or advise a person living in the ghetto who was being sent off to Vietnam to kill Vietnamese people when there was little opportunity for that person at home.
Yeah, you know, that killed it for him. People were furious with him. Johnson stopped talking to him. Fellow civil rights leaders criticized him. Newspapers really went after him. And I think about that speech, there are three things I think about that speech. One is that probably the only three people who have looked at it in the last 20 years are you, Rod Golden, and me. so no one, people are like, what speech? What are you talking about?
Google my name, Fetrakis, on the internet. I gave a speech on it a few years back at the AME church, and actually posted it last week and got a few hits on it
so
at thefreepress.org. I mean, and I was always drawn to it because he died one year
to the day. And you know how I am about conspiracy theories, but, you know, that's pretty strange, I think.
Yeah, well, under the surveillance of a Delta force, a top secret force of the U.S., government. I mean, my theory, you know, you saying what you say about, you know, Southern people, you know, white people accept you, I'm thinking is that you had the lone crazed gunman that may have friends in the military industrial complex will let you talk all you want about civil rights, but if you start attacking the military industrial complex and the national security state, then you're in trouble.
Yeah, and he saw it all as a. Actually, Malcolm got there before.
Even worse for him, from the perspective of the military industrial complex and those that make the money off it.
This was talking about human rights. He was bigger than that, and that's what people didn't like. People don't like you. You know, they like you to be in your little box, and there he was, the colored or the Negro or the black preacher, civil rights leader. What does he know about foreign policy?
And it so breaks with the rhetoric of the period that the Soviets were the embodiment of evil, and, you know, when we killed people in Vietnam with, you know, carpet bombing and napalm. We were doing that, for righteous, godly reasons. And he just sort of spelled out and said, the U.S. government is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world, as I speak.
Yeah, and the second thing I think about that is his wife had actually spoken out against the war a year or two before he did. So that took a lot of thought on his
part.
Well,
was that because she was one of those radicals from Antioch?
Yes.
Here in Ohio. she's hanging around there with Rod Sterling.
People forget that about her. And she grew up in an incredibly poor household. He was middle class, and he had the sensibilities of the middle class.
Essentially, perhaps the most radical peace, left-wing school in America at Antioch.
She got a scholarship, a music scholarship to go there. She's a concert trained pianist. So, but she talked about having to just eat once a day and barely making the ends meet. And she had grown up in circumstances that were much less desperate than his. He really was a child of the middle class and the favorite child in his household.
And both Antioch and Oberlin were initial training grounds that hooked up with people at Fisk and other places. A lot of that originally coming out of the historically.
Yes, Fisk was...
It was a Jim Lawson down there at Fisk.
Fisk was known as the Black Harvard. And people forget that Western College for Women, which was sort of subsumed by Miami of Ohio, that's where the Volunteers for Freedom Summer trained. So she was very much a part of that. But she started speaking out against the war a year or so before he did. So that, it took a lot of thought on his part. It took a lot of anguish. But he saw that, unlike what Johnson said, King knew we could not have guns and butter.
Well, it was not only a strategic question, it was a tactical question, but ultimately it looks like he approached it as a moral question.
He did. And, again, if you talk about morality, I don't know if you've listened to the tapes that have been released by the Kennedy Library of Jackie Kennedy, the oral interview she did after the president's assassination. But her husband apparently mentioned to her that Dr. King was being bugged, and it looked as though he was unfaithful. And she was like, oh, this horrible man. Well, pot calling the kettle black. Mm-hmm. But people say, because of that erases that moral side of him. And it doesn't. It doesn't. He saw this as everything being connected. He said about that, a nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. He marked racism, economic exploitation, and war as the triple evils. And you notice Korea, China, and the Soviet Union are not in there.
So, some have argued that it was a little easier to come out against the Vietnam War after Muhammad Ali. In many cases, if a boxer and Nation of Islam member could come out against the war, that King was stuck in a position of being marginalized. And I think, as you've pointed out, the I Have a Dream speech sort of keeps you in that position as a civil rights leader. But by the end, he's not only speaking out against the Vietnam War in 67, what he was doing with the Poor People's Movement was also a tremendous threat to the status quo in the United States.
What did he say when he went around to different neighborhoods? We're coming to Washington to get our check. And that had to be frightening.
So Martin Luther King, again, his holiday is tomorrow. You'll be hearing this on his official holiday. I'm speaking with Marilyn Howard, Dr. Marilyn Howard of Columbus State Community College. Any recent books coming out on King that we should be paying attention to?
There were several that have come out in the last several years. One is I think the one that I was most impressed with is The Gospel of Freedom by Jonathan Ryder. He's a professor at Brown University. And the subtitle is Martin Luther King Jr.'s Letter from a Birmingham Jail and the Struggle that Changed a Nation. And he literally picks that letter apart line by line, as my students will be doing sometime about the middle of this quarter, and shows the different faces of King: prophet, disappointed father, clergyman, that sort of thing. It's a fabulous book.
Now, what does the author mean by the gospel of freedom? Did King's understanding of freedom, was that limited to equal rights?
No, I think when you talk about the gospel, it's funny that you should ask that question, because when you talk about that, I went to Mass this morning, and the priest said that you live the gospel. If you have to talk about it, you talk about Paul's letters to the epistles. Mm-hmm. If you have to talk about it, fine, but you're really supposed to live the gospel. People are supposed to be looking at you and knowing that you are the gospel, walking, talking, breathing. And again, this goes back to him being a minister, being a preacher, being a prophet.
But when he spoke of freedom, what kind of freedom was he speaking of? I mean, is there freedom in this world? Was it freedom to achieve? Was it freedom to have opportunity? I know I've seen speeches where he defends, dissent and says, we particularly the young anti-war movement.
Freedom to him, when you look at his body of work, meant making true the promise of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, making that opportunity available for everyone.
Well, it's one thing to treat people equally in terms of opportunity, but at the end there, he's going over into that European United Nations. He's really talking about fundamental economic rights that would allow people to realize a lot of human potential. That's beyond voting, right? That's access, I'm thinking, to higher education,
yes.
Access to a job, the right not to live in poverty and have your life destroyed, the right to a fair wage. I mean, in many ways, socialistic comments and thoughts. I mean, he declared himself, towards the end there, he said he was a socialist on more than one occasion.
Well, that's odd because I came across an excerpt of a letter he had written his wife in 1952, his future wife at the time. But, people say he got more radical in his later years. Well, he talked in that letter about... I will certainly welcome the day to come when there will be a nationalization of industry and a better distribution of wealth. I imagine you already know I'm more socialistic in my economic theory than capitalist.
So he's what in Europe we'd call social democrat.
Yes.
He's clearly on the left of center. So yeah. In many ways you might be suggesting that these were his core values.
Yeah.
He may have suppressed them, do you think, because of the civil rights role he played, mm-hmm. by accident being in some ways the right place at the right time, and that simply what was coming out were the same values he had back there in 1952.
Yeah, he said that he wasn't against capitalism, and it started out as a good idea, but it had pretty much outlived its usefulness. So this was way back before even he got married. But I think that...
But you never hear about Martin Luther King, the social democrat. I mean, one of his key advisors, who I knew, Michael Harrington, would remind people that and say, look, I'm the country's foremost socialist, and I was one of his key advisors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people do forget. Well, who knows who Michael Harrington is? Again, you, me, and Rod Golden.
And Martin Luther King, though.
I'm sorry people didn't get to meet the funny king. And let me read you something here. He once preached a mock eulogy for his great friend, Andy Young. And he says, Lord, white folks have made a big mistake today. They've sent home to glory your faithful servant, Andrew Young. In Andrew Young, white folks had a friend so faithful, so enduring, that they never should have harmed a hair on his head. So he had a funny side, too.
All right, Martin Luther King and Julian Bond. Again, he claimed that King was walking around saying, this is a nightmare. And he said, why don't we be more positive? Why don't we have a dream instead of a nightmare?
I think we owe it to him to that he's a real, fully-fledged person.
All right, that's Dr. Marilyn Howard. This is Dr. Bob Petraeus. Thanking you for joining me on The Other Side of the News here on WCRS 98.3, 102.1. Thanks, Marilyn.
Thanks, Bob.